You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 20th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Leah Gordon, professor of education and history at Stanford University. On the rise of racial individualism in mid-century America, from power to prejudice. Also on the program today, we may not have Jim Webb, Democrat, to kick around anymore. We may just have Jim Webb, Independent, to kick around. Also on the program today, racists getting ready to boycott Star Wars. Only because it's so funny, folks. Only because it's so funny and so sad. And, oh, Canada. The Canadian election returns are in. The Liberals, in a stunning victory, and perhaps more important than their moniker, an anti-austerity campaign wins. Big. We will talk about that to the extent that we understand it. We're going to have a guest on in the coming days. We just didn't, I didn't realize that Canada was there. And so it didn't occur to me they were having an election. I kid, folks, I kid. We are only a couple of weeks away from the debt ceiling vote. It is unclear what's going to happen. Paul Ryan may. Just any day now, be kind enough to give us his decision on whether he'll run. And supposedly, he's only going to do so on his terms. He's not going to take any flack from the conservatives in the House. I wasn't even going to talk about this. I was going to talk about my conversation with Michael Steele on All In with Chris Hayes last night, but I don't know if I've made this point before about Paul Ryan. And stop me if anybody, Michael, if this resonates, if I've said this before. I don't know that Matt or Kelly were listening to the show last week or the week before. Maybe we were last week. But where is somebody going to ask the question, hey, if we're in a crisis mode where we don't have a Speaker of the House, the third most important person in the country, right? We just have a guy who's threatening, who wants to retire. John Boehner, I mean, God knows. I mean, look, if I was going to go into retirement and become a lobbyist, I'd be inebriated all the time.
I just want more drinks.
Right.
Please.
Now, is the YouTube stream up? Because I'm getting, is it up? Okay. YouTube stream should be up, folks. But my point is that where is Paul Ryan supposed to? Where is the complaints about his leadership? The country is calling him, and what's he doing? He's hiding out at home. Where's Ron Fournier? complaining about this guy's leadership skills. I mean, come on. This guy's letting America down. So I guess we'll see. I just don't. If he can't stand up to the conservative, how can this guy stand up to Putin? I mean, really? I mean, Putin's going to run roughshod over this guy.
You are a weak man.
There you have it. Paul Ryan, just not willing to stand up.
Ayn Rand will not help you now.
All right. So I wanted to just touch on what the conversation I had with Michael Steele on All In with Chris last night. We don't have a clip of it because they haven't put it up. I don't know why, but Michael Steele, I mean, it never occurred to me until sort of watching Jeb Bush, and I just thought, well, Jeb Bush is just a particularly bad candidate. And we have polling. We'll talk about the new polling later in the program. A particularly bad candidate. So maybe that is sort of writing it off. But to watch Michael Steele try and defend the premise George Bush kept us safe was sort of shocking. Now, look, I happen to believe that the Bush administration, as a policy matter, pursued the wrong policies in the lead up to 9/11. It's impossible to know whether or not had they actually reacted in a different way, had they had a different policy, had they had a different policy agenda and weren't so fixated on rogue states as opposed to non-state actors, whether or not they would have been able to stop it. There's no way to know that. There's no way to know that. But they clearly followed the wrong policy, right? When George Bush said, you've covered your ass now, now I got to go back to golf. I don't give a crap about Osama bin Laden. Clearly, they're following the wrong policy prescription. But it's undeniable that the guy was president on 9/11. If the words Bush kept us safe mean anything, it is from the time that he became president to the time that he went out, did he keep us safe? Now, let's put aside the whole construction of that, which is like a bedwetting, I need daddy to take care of me. But the fact is, the guy was president in January of 2001, we were attacked 9 months later. He failed. Now, maybe nobody could have stopped it, but he failed. Michael Steele said to me, we're going to play the audio tomorrow when we get it. Michael Steele said to me, well, yeah, okay, you have to understand, Republicans don't look at it that. They just start history at 9/12. And he was not saying this to be ironic. He was not saying this. He was saying this to refute what I was saying. There is a psychological defect on there. There is a psychological defect that the Republicans have here. And it's tied into the notion of where they only see their perceived value that they bring to the table. And it's fascinating. And it runs a lot deeper than just Jeb Bush trying to sort of protect his his brand. I keep getting IMs. Nobody IM me anymore that the YouTube is not up. The YouTube is not up. You got to check it. Go to the page. So they can't find it. I don't know where it is, but I don't want to get any more IMs about it. However, today's sponsor is Casper Mattresses. Obsessively engineered, American-made mattresses at a shockingly fair price. Now you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority using the code majority. Your average person spends about a third of your life sleeping. Now for me, it's more like 15 minutes because my kids wake me up. But you got to make sure you're doing it on a good mattress. Casper brings together two comfy technologies for better nights and brighter days. Latex foam and memory foam. So they got just the right sink, just the right bounce, no matter what. But look, the bottom line is you don't have to trust my description of these mattresses. Because this is the crazy part. They ship it to your door. and they have a free trial and return policy. You can try it for 100 days. That is, what, 3.1 months? And if you're not happy, they pick it back up. When you go and buy a mattress at a store, maybe you lie on it for 3 minutes. With Casper, you actually get to sleep on it for an extended period of time. It's $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size mattress. Great competitive price, but you get to try it at home for free. So get $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority using the coupon code MAJORITY. Terms and conditions do apply, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to do a little voice fry today because apparently
that's vocal fry.
Vocal fry.
Vocal fry. Vocal
that's
fry.
That's the new Sam Harris on this program. All right. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Leah Gordon.
You could be a shadow beneath the streetlight behind my home. Driving on 9, I sure miss you. Pass a motel, looking at the pines. Driving on 9, looking for 1:30. Maybe I passed it. Go.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Leah Gordon, she is a professor of education and history at Stanford University and the author of From Power to Prejudice, The Rise of Racial Individualism in Mid-Century America. Welcome to the program, Leah.
Thank you for having me.
Wait, I got it. Sorry, apologies. We had you down low. Welcome to the program, Leah.
Thank you for having me.
So, all right, let's start with just to give a broad overview for our audience. Your book looks at the sort of post-World War II era and sort of the history of how we've come to see race and racism in this country through a series of case studies on institutions that have, I guess, promulgated and in many ways sort of set up the framework of our thought when we look at racism. So give us at least at sort of at that time what the different visions of race problems and racism were in this country.
Sure. So I start from the premise that intellectual history is important to patterns of social inequality and racial injustice because how we understand the nature and sources of a social problem is profoundly important for the ways we imagine solutions. And in the mid-20th century, especially in the 1920s and 1930s and early 1940s, there were four primary ways of understanding the so-called race problem. And the race problem was the term that mid-century scholars and many activists used to think about what today we would call racism, but really was the intersection of prejudice, discrimination, segregation, racial injustice, inequality, oppression, without neatly distinguishing between them. So there was competition between four primary ways of understanding what this race problem was. Some suggested racism was essentially a psychological problem rooted in attitudes and best solved by anti-prejudice education. Gordon Allport, who talks about racism resting in white minds, is the primary example of this approach. Others, and the NAACP is the best example, describe the race issue largely in legal terms as the violation of African-American rights as individuals. In this view, the sources of the race problem were discriminatory laws and the first step forward with legal desegregation and anti-discrimination legislation. And the framework that I describe as racial individualism, which becomes particularly powerful in the post-World War II period, brings together the psychological individualism and this notion of individual rights. And yet in the 20s and 30s, there were two other very important ways of understanding the race issue. Some took a systemic approach, so many sociologists and anthropologists in the 20s and 30s focused on racial conflict and to some extent inequality, but suggested that large-scale social processes, systems, or structures cause these patterns. And Robert Park of the Chicago School of Social Ecology, who was a leading sociologist at the University of Chicago, was the most famous. He had this theory of a race-relations cycle that he thought was both inevitable and universal. It happened everywhere when certain kinds of patterns of migration and global trade created interracial contact. And then finally, there were advocates of a political economic vision of the race issue. And a lot of scholars brought together the systemic and political economic vision. But those who advocated a political economic vision put power relations, oppression, and the exploitation of some by others, I often call this a relational framework, at the center of their theories. This approach was especially popular among interracial groups of leftist activists during the Depression. There were a lot of leftist communist anti-racists, but also a whole range of leftists who essentially argued in the 1930s that racial injustice could not be separated from issues of class and economic injustice. Even many who were politically more moderate suggested in the 30s and in some of the places I look into the 40s and 50s that race and class were intimately intertwined because the roots of the race issue were slavery, colonialism, white supremacy, and the political economy of white supremacy. And prejudice was a rationalization. It followed from motivations that were largely economic and political.
Yes. I'm sorry.
So in the 20s through the 40s, those are the four frameworks I see competing. And what I'm interested in is in the post-World War II period, how the first two, the psychological individualism and rights-based individualism, not everywhere, not completely, but in a lot of cases, gain significant traction and in some ways sort of win out against the political, economic, and structural theories of racism.
Before we talk about how that vision sort of, I guess, triumphed or became more prominent and what the implications were of that, I mean, just broadly speaking, and this is sort of, I guess, a more general question, but did those four visions this is a more general question, but do they emanate from the built-in assumptions from those who are developing those visions? In other words, if I happen to be someone who is interested in psychology, I'm going to see this problem sort of from a psychological perspective. And if I am a Marxist or I am a socialist and I am arguing for a greater level of economic justice in the country, I'm going to see these issues within that context and so on. I wonder, like, what does it tell us as to which of those, if I'm correct in that, what does it tell us about what groups were ascendant or what value system was ascendant in the pre-World War era in the 20s and 30s? And what does that tell us about what was ascendant in the post-World War era as those visions or those competing visions sort of sorted themselves out in a particular way?
Yes, that's a great question, and that is part of what I am trying to figure out in the book, is what combination of intellectual and political dynamics favor some ways of understanding the race issue over others among particular groups of thinkers. And most of the people I'm looking at are social scientists who were in some way engaged in civil rights activism. And so what I find is that there are a combination of, so it's really hard to figure out why somebody believes what they do. And what I find is that there tend to be a combination of pressures on these social scientists shaping the kinds of theories that they articulate in when they're writing in a social scientific journal, as well as the kinds of theories they articulate in more political arenas, which are not always the same theory. So one of the things that the book really brings forward is what I describe as the scholar-activist dilemma, that what makes sense theoretically or what is going to a theory that is going to advance social science is not always the same theory that's politically practical in a particular context. And so there's certainly a lot of disciplinary distinction. So the psychologists tend to be predisposed to to focus on prejudice and to see the sources of the race issue resting in individual minds. But what a lot of the historical literature on this period had noticed was that that set of psychological assumptions had permeated other contexts, other disciplinary contexts. So sociologists started taking up really kind of psychological ways of thinking about the race issue, as well as many settings where people were discussing civil rights politics. So, for example, Gunnar Myrdal, who in 1944 publishes the study that people say is the study to end all studies on an American dilemma on the race issue in the United States. He's a Swedish social democrat and political economist. The bulk of this, like, 1,000-page volume is about the politics and economics of Southern white supremacy, and yet towards the end of the project, he decides to frame the issue. So he writes the introduction and the conclusion, which, because the volume is so long, tend to be the parts most people read, and frames the issue in terms of white morality and prejudice. So he discusses the race issue as a problem in the hearts and minds of many Americans. A number of sociologists also sort of go along with this largely psychological paradigm, and it also permeates a lot of anti-prejudice activism in the the wartime and post-World War II period. So both groups, like the National Conference of Christians and Jews, which had been predisposed to addressing first issues of interreligious conflict, but then after World War II, they start turning to racial conflict, and they address these issues through anti-prejudice educational techniques. So you would expect them to continue that approach in the post-war period. It's what they had been doing all along. It's what they were institutionally predisposed to do. But a lot of other groups that see anti-prejudice education as only a partial solution, also, especially during World War II, with the specter of Nazi racism, there are a lot of race riots during World War II that raise concerns about domestic unrest. Groups like some folks from the Fisk's Race Relations Institutes or authors writing in the Journal of Negro Education, which had a much more complex understanding of the nature of racial injustice, also embrace anti-prejudice education, though in very qualified and very limited ways, I think as a sort of political pragmatism. So what I find is that there's a combination of concern with social scientific pressures, so patterns of funding are part of the story, notions of method and the kinds of methodological tools that are available. This is the era of the social survey, and people are very excited about surveys that can study white attitudes, as well as the sense of what is politically feasible, converge to encourage even people you would not expect to embrace an individualistic approach to racial injustice to do that.
I mean, the last part, I mean, so basically the corralling, if you will, I mean, it sounds like it's almost like it's funneled into all these different sort of disparate perspectives, ultimately start to filter through this notion of racism being individualistic, and that it's
yes.
a psychological problem of white people, and I understand. I mean, obviously, there's people chase money to a certain extent, or rather, money filters out people, right? I mean, it's not so much mm-hmm. that people change what they believe when they're writing these scholarly journals. To get the money, it's just that the money is attracted to individuals who who share the money's, I guess, perspective on this. And they just tend to rise to the top because they attract the funding. But how is it, could it be that it was more sort of politically palatable? I mean, was that a notion of how politics had changed after the war, or was it just of the times?
Yeah. So what I was trying to, a lot of the existing history that I was building my own research agenda on was saying, had this sense that it was of the times. And I didn't quite buy that, right? I think I tend not to be convinced that there's kind of an ethos in the air. I think there have to be real reasons why people make choices. And so what I found when trying to figure out, at least in many of the elite white research institutions that were very closely tied to funding streams at the major foundations, that a collection of factors were encouraging funding patterns that favored what I call racial individualism, which is a term I developed to describe theories of the race problem that presented prejudiced attitudes and discriminatory actions as the root cause of racial conflict, that made individuals the unit of analysis in the study of race relations. So it both is a theoretical orientation and a empirical orientation. It's what you study when you're studying race relations. And that then had these implications for action, that implied racial justice could be secured by changing the minds of discriminating individuals through education and protecting the rights of African Americans in the face of unreformed bigots or their unjust laws. But what came together in the post-war period is first the rise of the behavioral sciences. So the post-World War II era had all this psychology gains a lot of support. There's a great book by Ellen Herman on the rise of psychologists and their ties to the federal government during World War I and then especially during World War II. And so psychology had sort of exploded as the new exciting field. The wartime and then post-World War II period also sees the development of social surveys. And so there's this new kind of attitude testing that is the hot new thing that many scholars, both psychologists, sociologists, some anthropologists are exposed to during World War II, working on government projects like Sam Stouffer's and The American Soldier. And foundations, the Ford Foundation in 1949, sponsor behavioral sciences initiatives. And yet what the behavioral sciences can mean is really fuzzy, and as soon as there's money behind it, everybody starts describing themselves as a behavioral sciences. But what people involved in the behavioral sciences, which was an interdisciplinary approach to all kinds of social issues, and in some ways I think the individualizing of research on the race issue was a casualty of this broader turn to behavioralism across the social sciences. What behavioralism focused on was individual and group intentions and behaviors rather than political economy. And there's a great book by a historian, Howard Brick, that looks at sort of the decline, it's called Transcending Capitalism, the decline of political economic analysis among sociologists generally in this period. So you see places like Harvard dissolve their sociology department and their psychology department and develop a department of social relations, which is a term that gets used pretty similarly to behavioralism in the post-war period, that blurs the lines between those two departments, but really drops politics and economics out of the equation. Now, it's not entirely coincidental that this is all happening amidst post-war McCarthyism.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, it sounds to me like you could also look at this from the perspective of, and this starts to bring it into this, I think, why you know, so much of this is relevant, particularly in this day and age. But mm-hmm. It can also be viewed as to what, not even so much where the perspective on this thing on race is sort of gravitating towards, but rather where it's running from, because this is we're talking the Cold War now, and the idea of racism being in any way enhancing or strengthening or edifying or being a function of structural wealth inequality and mm-hmm. It seems to me to be extremely threatening to not just the sort of the usual suspects, but also to sort of the entire conception of the American psyche. We're not communist,
yes.
Right?
Yes, yes. And it's race, to talk about race in the post-war period was radical enough, right? So we have a long history of anybody advocating for racial justice, regardless of how they're doing it, being called a communist. By the post-war period, though, places like the Rockefeller Foundation, I have this chapter on the Rockefeller Foundation, are working under a number of pressures. One of them is that there are congressional investigations into the leading foundations. You know, McCarthyists in Congress are basically arguing that places like Rockefeller and Carnegie were supporting leftist propaganda. And so they're under very discreet pressure to be careful about how they're addressing issues in class issues in general, but any kind of issue related to race. And there's a memorandum at the Rockefeller Foundation in 1946 where one advisor says, well, he's discussing how the Rockefeller Foundation should support not just social science, but especially reform approaches to the race issue. And he says, well, we just can't support propagandistic organizations like the NAACP or the American Council on Race Relations, neither of which were radical at all.
Right.
So the fact that those largely liberal organizations were being deemed communist, I think, points to the way in which McCarthyism was sort of shaping the terms of debate, even when people weren't talking about the fact that that was happening. I think the other thing that's interesting is that in the mid-40s had seen a debate over the National Sciences Foundation, and there was a debate about whether the social sciences were objective enough to be included in the to get National Science Foundation funding. And those debates also turned to Gunnar Myrdal's An American Dilemma. Opponents of including the social sciences in the NSF said, well, those social scientists are really all just political radicals. The work they're doing is leftist propaganda. And again, it was Myrdal's An American Dilemma that was which, as I just said, framed the race issue in terms of hearts and minds. Even so, it was trotted out by conservatives as an example of how social scientists were really all just political radicals. So I think you're right that there was this, often in combination with behavioralism, there was often this unsaid context of race is dangerous enough to talk about. To talk about it in combination with class is really dangerous. And yet I will say I have a chapter on the Fisk Race Relations Institutes, which were these summer conferences that brought together social scientists and political activists starting in 1944, as well as Howard University's Journal of Negro Education. And Howard had been a center of black leftist thought in the 1930s. And theoretical approaches to the race issue, theoretical alternatives to racial individualism, so theories that rooted racism in political oppression, that called prejudice a rationalization for exploitation, so theories that were political, economic, and social structural continued in those settings, really even into the mid-1950s, though they became somewhat more muted in the more cautious participants in those. People like Charles S. Johnson, who was a favorite of the foundations, became the first African-American president of Fisk University, was quite cautious in how he used systemic theories. What I found in both of those locations is that behavioralism never made the kind of inroads, and the concern with prejudice never made the kind of inroads in those settings that it did in places like the Rockefeller Foundation, Harvard, the University of Chicago. What did change in the discourse there was the embrace of racial liberalism. So I think partly as a result of McCarthyism and the coincidence of McCarthyism and the progress towards a legal attack against Plessy v. Ferguson by 1950. So by 1950, it's starting to look like the NAACP is actually going to win the fight against legal desegregation. These locations sort of coalesce around notions of civil rights that push to some extent to the sidelines the more redistributive elements that had been part of their visions of how to respond to racial injustice. So in the theoretical realm, these settings continue to have political, economic, and social structural theories of the racism, but when it comes time to translate those theories into politics, a lot of scholars and scholar activists there pull their punches and do what they think is politically reasonable, which is an entirely reasonable thing to do, especially when you're in a setting where McCarthyism is such a pressure and legal desegregation seems reasonable on the horizon. And yet I think those choices wind up having long-term consequences in combination with the turn to the behavioral in the more mainstream academy.
So, I mean, so let's talk about what the consequences and the implications are of this. I mean, to a certain extent, it seems like there's a certain amount of tension, right? I mean, that is ongoing between this notion of perceiving racism as wholly a sort of like a mental defect versus racism as wedded and embedded in the social and economic structure on which this country was basically designed in many respects. Just sort of track for us that tension as it exists. I mean, you know, things pop up as just off the top of my head, like where, you know, things like Medicare and, you know, the Great Society under LBJ, it sort of unspoken, at least on the side that's pushing for economic justice. It seems to be fairly explicit on the side of people, of the Dixiecrats, who basically said, yeah, we're not going to get involved in this, and we're bolting for the door. And then even up through the Moynihan Report, where this idea of I guess it's maybe the flip side of racism being a psychological disorder of white people, as opposed to something sort of like a greater societal question. And the plight of African Americans being a function of sort of their own individual deficiencies.
Yeah. So the kind of individualism I was interested in the 40s and 50s interested me in part because it seems to fit so logically with the more familiar individualism that scholars of poverty and race of the post-1960s period, this is sort of one of the main themes in scholarship on race and poverty in the post-1960s into the 1980s is culture of poverty theories, right? Where the sources of racial inequality in these theories, which I reject, are rooted in black culture, black communities, and rather than in political economy. So that is the familiar way of individualizing the race issue and blaming the victim in that case. But what I was trying to do was to say, okay, there's this other also individualistic way of avoiding the argument that racism is intimately intertwined with our political economic structures, and moving away from the argument that has emerged again and again by the black and interracial lefts, that there's something inextricable about the connections between racial injustice and capitalism and the inequalities it produces. And so I think what happens in the 1960s, which is the end point of my study, is that in some ways you see structural and political economic analysis come back. You certainly, by the late 60s, among black power advocates, and even King has a lot of economic
MLK at the end.
Rhetoric.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, it turns very much to... So I think this strand that kind of survives from the 30s in places like Fisk's Institutes and Howard's Journal of Negro Education returns really with a vengeance among black power activists. I mean, they talk about the ghetto as a colony, patterns of internal colonialism. And among many of the, you know, I think there's a whole variety in the 60s black left who point to these issues. And as much as Moynihan, you know, needs to be attacked for his focus on the culture of poverty, he also has an economic analysis at the root of what he's arguing, right? I mean, he's suggesting that unemployment is... And the absence... I mean, he has the sort of ridiculous argument about holdovers from slavery, but he also... is in some ways a structuralist in that he's suggesting that it is the absence of jobs in black urban communities that is causing these cultural deficiencies. So there are ways in which the structural analysis comes back in the 60s, but what we've never been very good at is acting on that. So much of the literature on the war on poverty suggests that in some ways we do a really good job with protecting individual rights, but we have been done a less good job at following through on the redistributive emphases of some of these leftist visions of the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Now, this goes beyond, obviously, your study, but, I mean, this tension, it mm-hmm. seems to me, continues through the 70s, particularly through the 80s and the 90s, when mm-hmm. we start to sort of reinterpret Martin Luther King and sort of cut out those last parts about the economic
right,
justice
right.
issue.
He's all the color, the content of our character, and none of the, you know, we're fighting militarism, capitalism, and racism together.
And it seems like we have, even today, a very good, I mean, there's a couple of examples of where we see these, you know, we see on the right, Paul Ryan going up there and talking about a kid who gets a, you know, makes up a story about a kid getting a bag of lunch. And, you know, he would rather, you know, have a homemade lunch rather than one from school, because that means somebody loves him. And it getting into this whole culture of poverty thing. What's interesting to me is that what we've seen with Bernie Sanders in relationship to Black Lives Matter is that Bernie Sanders was coming from that tradition of seeing, you know, the sort of the, I guess, the political and economic power relations, and had to sort of adjust slightly to recognize what is not necessarily a new phenomenon, but I guess there's a new awareness of that there's a sort of an urgency to individuals as a function of broader societal, you know, demonization of Black people. I mean, so how does that dynamic fit in?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think the Black Lives Matter movement now is very interesting because it's following in a long tradition of grassroots political sort of insurgency that is arguing again that racism is intimately intertwined with capitalism, that these are patterns of oppression and exploitation. So there's a language of oppression in the Black Lives Matter movement that you see both on some of the websites and then also some of the coverage of, you know, people in the street in Baltimore or in Ferguson. We're tying, so there's two kinds of systemic racism being addressed, I think, and really put on the political landscape in crucial ways by the Black Lives Matter movement and the sort of in the recent discussions of the uprisings in Baltimore, Ferguson, and elsewhere. One is that police brutality, which you could see as just a function of individual prejudice, you could run psychological right. tests on the police, but that it's not an individual issue, that the issue is its systemic character. The issue is how often it's happening, the policies that are allowing to happen, that these patterns of violence to happen to some, to African American groups and not others, that discrimination is in these cases systemic. So I think there's a systemic nature theory of discrimination going on that what's crucial in the present moment is how that's being put on international discussion, as well as the systemic crisis of mass incarceration. And then at the same time, I think a number of activists are also saying, in addition to the problems of police brutality in these communities, let's also talk about the absence of jobs, the poor quality of the schools, the poor quality of our social services, so that the discussion of racism in those communities is not only about what a bigoted police officer may not have done, but about the disinvestment in those communities as well, and the challenges of poverty and inequality that are the result of communities being left behind. So I think it's an economic structuralism and a systemic theory of discrimination that are being brought into public discussion. And old leftists like Bernie Sanders may be a little more familiar with the economic structuralism right. than the systemic theories of discrimination. And I think it's wonderful that he and Hillary Clinton are being pushed to do both to see the two as intimately intertwined.
Let me ask you just, and this may be a little bit granular, but when when one says, like, do the solutions, let's say, to that systemic racism that was in the police force, is there a distinction between saying, I think there should be sensitivity training for police officers so that they don't go into these situations and perceive and so they can deal with their own personal racism. Is there a difference between that and saying we need body cameras on the cops because the task? I mean, you know, there is a theory that like, look, society has basically said has structurally created these type of situations where you have incredibly low employment, where you have a lack of social services, where you have people trapped in poverty. And then what we do is we go out to hire the cops to basically keep those people from getting out of their cages, more or less. I mean, metaphorically speaking.
There's a great quote by James Baldwin about, you know, how it's the white policeman who's on the front lines of the injustice we've all created.
Right, exactly. Like, you know, we basically hire them. That's part of their job description. We don't necessarily put it in there, but it's understood. And that putting body cameras on the police officers basically it holds them accountable, but what it does is it really makes society confront ultimately that implied directive that we've given to the police, because at one point it then becomes a much more public debate about sending conflicting messages. I mean, are those two solutions, do they stem from a different perspective on looking at the problem, or are they more or less similar?
Yeah, that's a good question. So certainly to say that sensitivity training alone is the way to handle this pattern of police brutality would, I think, fall into the individualistic approach I'm describing. And they're actually in the 40s and 50s. That was part of the program that many civil rights activists, who I would describe as racial liberals, were promoting. I think you're right that the body camera and the way the body camera brings other voices and other authorities into the discussion does complicate the issue. But I wonder if, you know, I think to think about what so certainly a political economic theory of what is happening in police community relations would get beyond just what's happening in the individual interpersonal interaction between police and particular community members, and would look at who is making decisions on the police commission. What voice does the community have in those kinds of decisions? How much can the community be controlling what the kinds of policing that are happening? And would then get beyond just police community relations to questions of disinvestment and economics. But certainly, I think the technology today is changing the way people are thinking about the nature of race relations in poor communities by, one, just making it visible to many people for whom it's not visible, and by inserting by providing evidence that, you know, Michael Brown's friend can have on his cell phone evidence of what happened. And so I think there is some really radical potential in strangely in the cell phone, since it can create a certain kind of authority for voices that were not given that sort of authority before.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Leah Gordon, the book is From Power to Prejudice, The Rise of Racial Individualism in Mid-Century America. Thank you so much for your time. We'll put a link up at majority.fm to your book, and appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. It was a little weedy, but fascinating stuff, because we can still sort of see the implications of it. And, you know, some of the answers that are provided for social ills give you an indication of who is promulgating them and why, so that maybe some other questions are not necessarily addressed. So here you have that. We're going to head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be a part of the program, you can IM me at Majority FM. Hopefully we are now up on YouTube. Yes, we've got that settled. And folks, just a reminder. Someone, Michael told me, said, you know, we got a, what was it, an email or something? Or someone tweeted?
Just a loose comment somewhere.
A loose comment. Michael picks up loose comments off the floor. Suggesting that our advertising was now paying for the program. And we have been, we've been on a streak for the past like month where we have like an advertisement a day, short of those days where, you know, we say we're not going to advertise for companies that may be under federal investigation. I don't think that's a very high bar that we do there. I mean, of course, we let Michael stay here, but that's just because I feel like individuals deserve more of a benefit of the doubt.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. And
I got to go.
Well, I understand.
I have a meeting. Is your
bracelet ringing?
We're not at that point yet. I have to talk to my lawyers.
But the point being, folks, that nevertheless, we still get 98.8% of our revenue from members. And your support makes the free show possible. And as a way of saying thank you, what we do is we give you some bonus content. So if you can afford to, please support the program. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. If you like coffee and you buy like whatever it is, like $12 bag, you know, pounds of coffee, like nice coffee, you should be buying it from justcoffee.coop. Why? I've got 8 reasons. And I may have to do some reasons twice to hit 8 because I just pulled that number out of my head. One is, it's all fair trade. Everybody involved in the process gets a fair wage. 2 is, it's a co-op. The owners are the employees. 3 is, these guys helped out the protesters in Wisconsin. They're in Wisconsin. They're in Madison. 4 is, you get 10% off with the coupon code MAJORITY. 5 is, you can buy the WTF blend. It makes a great gift for people. 6 is, the coffee is delicious. 7 is, it comes right to your door. 8 is, you can buy the coffee there and not buy Marc Maron's WTF blend. And you're doing, it's like a double mitzvah, as we say. And of course, if you buy craft from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. We're going to take a quick break. Oh, the new episode of Sportocracy is up. Sportocracy, folks. This one is, coincidentally, on DraftKings and FanDuel. So if you don't understand the controversy that's going on there, check out Sportocracy. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
And I prepare.